This one is recording as well. So my name is Greg Downey. I'm conducting this interview on Thursday, July 29th, 2010. And if you could pronounce and spell your name for us.
Laura Heisler, L-A-U-R-A-H-E-I-S-L-E-R.
Great, thanks, Laura. And we're here in the Wharf building. Again, some of this introduction is going to sound a little strange since you and I do know each other. With support from Wharf, we're undertaking interviews for an oral history archive on the early years of the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery. Our aim is to record the perceptions of all those people involved in the conceptualization and initial development of the twin institutes, the WID and the MIR, for lack of a better term. That is why I would like to interview you today. And although those of us involved in the project know quite a bit about the development of the WID and the MIR, the archive we are creating will be used by scholars down the road who have little firsthand experience with the institutes. So I'm going to ask you some questions that will probably seem kind of basic, things we might have covered before in other conversations. And even within the interview script, there's a little bit of repetition you might pick up on. Part of that is to make sure to sort of get it different issues through similar kinds of questions or the same issue through different kinds of questions. But we'll try not to take more than an hour of your time, okay? So the first question is the most basic one. Could you just, in your own words, sort of describe your role in the early development and conceptualization of the twin institutes? And by that I mean, you know, maybe start with your formal role and then maybe we'll work into more of the informal.
I've actually been involved with the project since 2006, and I've had multiple roles that have evolved along with the project. So, and I will just jump in right away and say that in addition to the two research institutes, there's the town center, and so we think of it as actually a three-part entity. My role started with the project team, the building project team, which was the first group that was created once the architects were selected and the initial concept of what entities were going to exist had been figured out. There had been previous groups to that, and I know that you've done some work on the Agile Committee and the Initial Steering Committee, et cetera, before WID and Mortgage were born. Once WID and Mortgage were born, there was this project team headed up by George Austin, and I was a member of that. And so I worked closely with the architects and with George and his Wharf consultant colleagues, John Nelson and Rose Barlett, and had the formal responsibility of leading benchmarking efforts to understand other institutes around the country and around the world and what we might learn from them architecturally and programmatically. So I did that for from beginning in 2006, and for about a year and a half, had a formal role on the project team. I was also a member of the mortgage program development team, which was spurred by Wharf, headed up formally by Mike Falk, and I was strongly involved in that and attended and organized almost all of those meetings. And then I was an unofficial, basically, auditor of the WID program team, which was also going at that time, headed up by Marcia Seltzer. So I was involved in all of those components back in 2006. In the fall of 2007, Carl Gulbranson asked me if I would head up a search for an executive director for the Mortgage Institute. There had been a search done by an outside search firm, and I honestly don't remember the name of that firm, but I could get it if it were important. And that really was not successful. The Wharf Board of Trustees and the Mortgage Board of Trustees, which had been formed at this time, was not happy with any of the candidates. And so Carl decided to reboot and asked me if I would head that up. And so I then, to do that role effectively, he and I both felt I needed a formal title and a formal position that would allow me access to potential candidates. And so my title became mortgage program developer, so program developer for the Mortgage Institute for Research. And I was for a short time officially an employee of the Mortgage Institute because our accountants felt that it might be important for tax purposes. That was pulled back after a couple months, but I had a business card with a mortgage logo. And my title was Mortgage Institute Program Developer. And I still retained my Wharf job titles. I had two job titles with Wharf at that time, too. So I had three boxes of business cards. and that search took a year. And I had to create a job description for what the mortgage executive director would do and then identify potential candidates and bring them to the board. So that was my role with that. That was successful. And in the fall of 2008, as that was at a close because we'd hired someone, Carl asked me if I would then head up an effort to figure out how the town center should be structured and what would go on there, and basically be the program director for the town center. Mm-hmm. And officially, on January 1st, 2009, I was officially promoted and became WARF Director of Programming, responsible for the town center, but also responsible for other things. So it's always been clear that my job is not, I'm not director of the town center, I'm WARF Director of Programming. And at that time, and this was an idea in development, I would say through 2008, the idea was that the town center would not belong to either WID or Mortgage, but would be an honest broker and serve both entities and the campus and WARF, and would be managed through WARF. Mm-hmm. And so that is where I am today.
Excellent. Which really means we should be interviewing you three times for your
Now my business card's out.
So you started to get into this a little bit. Could you talk a little bit more about what you think, beyond sort of the roles you fulfilled in this process formally, what particular knowledge or experience do you feel that you brought to the early development of the project?
So the early development of the project was very much focused on understanding the scientific space that WID and Mortgage should occupy, as well as the public-private interface between the institutes, as well as between the university and the rest of the world, the business sector. So I feel like I brought elements to both of those big areas. I have a PhD in molecular biology and have worked in science and in the private sector for most of my career. So I brought some understanding of science. You know, there were many scientists involved in different aspects of the project, but I helped the project team and the mortgage team by being a scientist and understanding how science is done. You know, not comprehensively, but you know, in the area that I am knowledgeable about. And then also a good understanding of the interface between business and science and business in the university. So I think I brought those elements. But I did not bring any expertise in architecture or design or organizational structures of private research institutes. That's all stuff I learned on the job.
And in terms of both the expertise you brought and then sort of the expertise you acquired as you were kind of thrown into this and working through this, if you had to point to your particular influence on the way the project developed, was there anything that comes to mind that you'd point to?
I think my signature really is a mode of working that I think has added to the project for better or for worse, which is to gather a lot of input. So I created a lot of advisors and a lot of focus groups. And the focus group approach had already been started. So in 2005 and 2006, there were some focus groups that Carl basically organized through the early steering committee, again, before WID and Mortgage were even born. And so that sort of, you know, been in the culture, and I really threw myself into a lot of that and worked with people I knew to be engaged or people whose experience I knew would be relevant. For example, one of the focus groups that I'm particularly, I think was particularly influential on a number of levels with how the project developed, was one that brought in all of the alums of what's called the MRC in Cambridge, I think it stands for Medical Research Center. It's at Cambridge University. It's where Watson and Crick were. It had a disproportionate quantity of Nobel laureates and massive discoveries in medicine and biotech and molecular biology. And I knew from my PhD work here that there were a large number of alums from that center here on campus, and that I knew that Genelia Farms, which was one of the models that I benchmarked, was set up the way it was because its director had spent his formative years there as well at the MRC. So I thought we would learn a lot by hearing from the MRC folks here what made that place so special. And so we had a dinner of that group, and a lot of things came out of that actually found their way into the building. For example, the second floor dining space that we have in the facility came directly from that conversation that we had, as well as a lot of elements of how we should think about mm-hmm. what the Mortgage Institute ought to do.
And by the second floor dining space, you mean the idea that there should be, you know, yep. a separate
That's
dining
right.
space for the folks working
right.
in the building day
That's
to day.
Right. Yeah. That is something that all the alums from the MRC pointed to as a transformational part of the culture there, mm-hmm. is that Sidney Brenner would sit down to some no-name graduate next to some no-name graduate student at lunch, and they sat there every day, and amazing things happened.
Yeah.
Just that people, you know, let their hair down, instill their work scientific context, and mm-hmm. that's when creative things would happen. Mm-hmm. So I would say what I brought was an ability to take input and think about the next step and talk to people and hear from them and make connections and bring people together. And that's
right.
sort of how I continue to do what I'm doing and
right.
how I led the search for the mortgage director was I spent most of my time talking to people and hearing from them and then making
yeah.
connections
yeah.
and exploring them.
Yeah.
So I think that led to some of the expansiveness in the thinking. And I think that's what wasn't happening, for example, with the search firm for
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
for the executive director and why it wasn't successful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it relates directly to a question I have talking about the differences between formal responsibilities and some of the informal connections that you might have made along this process.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Your job and your role really straddled both of those and
mm-hmm.
put those together.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other moments, unexpected informal moments in this process that you'd point to that were important or that?
I think there were actually another thing that, so I felt that I had some impact by going to the other institutes around the country that we
yeah.
chose to benchmark and noticing certain things that and it wasn't just me. I mean, other people, too, when we were on these trips. In fact, the whole design of the town center came from a visit that I happened to be on with the architects at a building in Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
Actually
mm-hmm.
a commercial building in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Genzyme. It's a pharmaceutical company, Genzyme. And from being in that space, I could see our lead architect figure out exactly what the town center needed to be. So
mm-hmm.
going on some of those visits and talking to people and bringing certain notable elements back to the project team, back to George Austin's team, I think led to some things happening differently. Jamelia
mm-hmm.
Farm made a very big impression on me. No one from the project team went. I insisted that they hear from me what I thought we had to take a look at, and then ultimately the architects went, and I
yeah.
think some of those elements found their way in.
Oh, excellent.
So, yeah.
Okay. That was all question number one, by
okay,
the way.
Sorry.
That's
you,
wonderful.
You said, you can talk forever.
Question number one is pretty much the first
okay.
page, so we're right on track. I want to talk a little bit now about the philosophy and the ideas behind the institutes, and ask you in the beginning, what were the big picture reasons for establishing the institutes? How would you describe that today?
You know, I think, and you know, this is the story I tell, and what I understand to be true,
yeah.
Is that Governor Doyle wanted to have a way of putting his stamp on the scientific research enterprise here
mm-hmm.
to keep Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
competitive
mm-hmm.
In response to the California Stem Cell Initiative,
mm-hmm.
and that he actually had some flexibility in terms of resources to try and do that. And I was actually at the press conference when he made this announcement in 2004 at Monona Terrace.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing concrete about it that I remember. And then, you know, my understanding, and I wasn't present for this, but I've certainly been around to see it hold up, is that John Morkridge was very inspired by the Clark Center
mm-hmm.
And wanted to see us do something here. And I do know from firsthand experience that John likes to get Stanford and Wharf and Wisconsin to learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
I've been participant in other examples of that firsthand, where he's taken me in his car to meet with people at Stanford to hear more about what they do because he is impressed by a certain program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my understanding, that he was very impressed by the goals of the Clark Center and the BioX
right.
program to create more impactful work at the interfaces of the major trends in scientific research,
mm-hmm.
and that he wanted to see that happen, and that he was very impressed by the spokes radiating from that through the BioX program at Stanford that reach out to the whole campus
mm-hmm.
and to the
mm-hmm.
rest of the community. So the BioX program has an effort to connect with industry and an effort to connect with K-12 schools in the area, and just that whole impact beyond itself mm-hmm. approach to doing things mm-hmm. is what was the genesis of how this came together?
Right. So besides the motivations to do something, political wishes on the part of a governor, an important and savvy donor, examples around the country of good things happening that we want to be able to respond to and learn from here. Were there other things at the particular time that we're talking about, 2006, 2004, that made this venture possible that you could point to?
I think Wharf was, the stock market was very robust, mm-hmm. and so Wharf, I think that the trustees felt very comfortable that Wharf was in a position to take on an ambitious venture.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. so I think that was part of the thinking. Mm-hmm. I wasn't part of those conversations. I didn't attend the board meetings or anything, but I know that, from just being an employee at Wharf, yeah. that I started in 2004, that it was a strong period mm-hmm. for the organization, and
okay.
so that it wasn't, it didn't feel at all that it had to be conservative necessarily,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and that there were, various ideas, and I was part of a different initiative that was also kind of a risk-taking effort to build a legacy for Wharf to mm-hmm. go to the next level,
mm-hmm.
And I think that was somewhat in the air. I was heading up something called the Strategic Technology Enhancement Program, which, very different scale, but something to lay the groundwork for a successful future.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was kind of in the air from Wharf's perspective.
Okay.
On the university side, I honestly don't know beyond the influence of the mortgages and the governor,
mm-hmm.
if there were things. I kind of think not. I think that the trend at the university had been, we identify a need and we solicit mm-hmm. a gift for that need, and this
yeah.
definitely was breaking that mold.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of my next questions deals with what models or examples that the institutes drew on, and you've already talked about
mm-hmm.
that and described how your role was intrinsically connected to seeking out and, mm-hmm. and touring and thinking about those models.
There were others, and I don't know if you need a
comprehensive list. Yeah, if you can mention
list.
Some of the others,
that would
be great.
The Stowers Institute in Kansas, near Kansas City, was one that early on,
mm-hmm.
Some of the core leaders, Carl, Marcia Seltzer, and a couple others, looked at, and then I looked at more carefully. There was Genelia, there was the Broad at MIT
mm-hmm.
that
okay.
I've actually gone to a couple of times. The Whitehead Institute is another one that we looked at. We looked at, basically the whole compendium of successful private research institutes that are somehow affiliated with large research universities,
mm-hmm.
Salk and Scripps
mm-hmm.
and Burnham, Gladstone. So those are all models for different things.
Yeah. Did it seem like there were other people at the time who were doing a similar sort of thing, like trying to look at these models and learn from them, or abstract from them, or find the formula to create the next one? Or what, did you feel like you were doing something that people hadn't really
yeah,
stumbled upon before?
That's a good question. I didn't have the sense at that time that there were a lot of people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I since learned that, and we identified a consultant through, in these wanderings. Actually, this is another one back to another subset of part one of surprising sort of unanticipated things that have been impactful.
Yeah.
Identified a consultant who is, he's an accountant, he's a CPA, but he's basically a consultant to the majority of successful private research institutes
mm.
in the country. And so that's been a huge asset in getting especially mortgage off the ground, is to have this person who knows how all of these things have been set up
mm.
and it works
mm-hmm.
with them and can
mm-hmm.
make connections for us, and he's been tremendously valuable.
Is that a person you can give us a name
Yeah, his
for?
Name's Bob Forrester,
okay.
and he actually
yep.
works for us as a consultant, so we brought him out here. And and actually another important person, Rogers Hollingsworth,
okay.
Who a lot of people here know, I guess he's emeritus here.
Mm-hmm.
His name had been brought in, not through me, but by Gwen Drury, but we had conversations with him, and those things were also useful, and I had brought him into a meeting with Carl
mm-hmm,
to
mm-hmm.
explore things. So, no, I actually didn't have the impression that other people were doing that. I will say, though, the caveat is we hired a consultant. His name is Richard Reitz, who's a building consultant, hardcore, like writes for magazines that talk about research buildings
mm-hmm.
and the whole industry. There's an award, Lab of the Year Award, and he's on the jury of the Lab of the Year Award. So he was someone John
mm-hmm.
Nelson brought in, and I did a lot of traveling with Richard, and Richard had an encyclopedic knowledge of the guts of research buildings. So not so much programmatically, but in terms of the layout, and do they have a boiler room, and do they have a vivarium, and how many square feet per PI, and how much glass. So that is his gig. Okay. And he was instrumental in a lot of elements of the benchmarking.
So given all the people you were networking with over this period, and the push to do something innovative, transformative, and the models you were looking at, can you talk a little bit about how the early conception for what the institutes would be here, how that changed over time? What were some of the, I don't know, most striking or interesting changes, if any?
Interesting. Okay. And I know you guys have some of the historic documents, the famous Red Book. When I look back at the Red Book, I actually find it to be remarkably prescient in how things ended up being structured.
Okay.
There was no sense of how faculty would be brought in, and there was a lot of consternation about that. And I think no one anticipated the cluster model as being as important as it would end up being in the WID side. That was something that, you know, was just born one day and really stuck. Remind me of the question you had, like, did you say surprises or?
Well, just how did the conceptualization of, you know, what the project was change over time?
Right.
What strikes you now is something that changed?
I guess one thing, change and then change back. So one thing was an uncertainty, but an anticipated desire to see WID and mortgage complementary, and then during the formative years of them, that completely fell apart, and there wasn't any, organizational or institutional effort to make sure that they would be. In fact, there was quite an effort to make sure they wouldn't be, because the WID program team made no allowance for having either anybody from WARF or anybody from Mortgage on the committee to select the WID scientists. And it was a notable omission. So that seemed like it had evolved away from this sense that they needed to complement.
Yeah.
But then when the actual person of Sang Kim came, and the person of John Wiley went into WID, and they had a history together, a positive history, then it came back, and John made sure that Sang Kim was involved in helping select the WID theme. So it came back to what it was originally intended to be, but for a long time it looked like it wasn't going to go that way. For a long time it looked like we would really be operating very independently. There was a moment when we were trying to figure out some kind of a web presence, and the university position, not necessarily official from high up, but from the person in the room from communications, was, well, we probably just need two different websites. And we figured out a way to have an umbrella. But there are, and I guess I would say also just, I think no one in the beginning anticipated the operational challenges of having a large state-run agency in the form of the university collaborating with a private entity to turn on the heat and to have the lights and to bring back overhead and to, and this has been a challenge for this past year with the town center, to operate a space that is not divisible. I mean, there is a property line, but it runs through rooms. How do we do that? And that, I think, has been an unanticipated set of complications that people may have been aware of it, but I don't think many people wanted to think about it.
That's
in
interesting.
All of its gory detail. Yeah. And we have spent most of the last year, there's been a huge amount of person hours on the question of how do we run the building. And they are not all solved.
And with your role so tightly tied to the town center, kind of literally the foundation of those two spaces, it seems like a lot of that work has fallen through your
office. Actually, surprisingly, not all that much. It really has come down, our poor facilities director has spent a lot of time trying to figure out who's going to clean the spaces. And I've been focused on it with respect to the food venues, because two of them are on our side of the property line and one's on the university side of the property line. And so, but we've set up one freezer. So what's gonna, and that's been interesting, and I don't think anybody anticipated that it would have been resolved the way that it is apparently going to be resolved. And then had a meeting yesterday with facilities and planning about how to coordinate space on the university side versus on the WARF-owned side, because there are ways that the university allocates space. The property line literally bisects two rooms. are people interested in space going to go to different people to depending on where they should be, mm-hmm. and how are we going to mm-hmm. fix that? And yeah. so that's a work in progress.
Okay.
So I don't think I don't remember conversations about that.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
Yeah. So, no, that's a really interesting description because my sense is that someone looking at the project today might assume that those kinds of considerations
right.
were what drove the original kind of
right.
Combination of the yeah. two themes, and you're really talking about two separate stories that are hitting at different times.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, exactly. So the science pieces, I think, have come together as originally conceived, even though the path wasn't mm-hmm. from here to there.
Yeah.
It went from here, you know.
Yeah.
But the facility itself, I think if we had known it would be like this, it wouldn't be designed the way it is. There wouldn't be rooms that are bisected by the mm-hmm. property line. There wouldn't be bathrooms just on one side. maybe there would be different meters. I don't think anybody thought... And there would have been
yeah.
two freezers that, you know, we
yeah.
would have known, okay, it's not going to be a reconcilable thing. The university has obligations with respect to labor unions and things mm-hmm. like that the private mm-hmm. side doesn't. We should be thinking about that. So
right.
I think that was, just something that no one saw coming.
Was there ever a notion that the building was going to and needed to be constructed for a lifetime that might extend beyond the particular combination of the institutes and how that was working? I mean, was there a sense that this combination of
right.
the practices and the people involved is the thing that's going to drive
An interesting question. So I think it's gone both ways, and it's always been fascinating to me because the building was designed to be a 100-year building
mm-hmm.
and designed to be agnostic about what science was going to go in there and what science itself would be like as time goes on,
mm-hmm.
recognizing that we are in a period of incredible dynamism and how research is done.
Right.
That said, so there was this great sense to be as flexible and changeable as possible, so this would be a 100-year building. At the same time, I would see major decisions being made based on what one person's input was about how one certain thing is done.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this great need on the part of the architects and people building, who actually need to build buildings and need real inputs, like,
right.
well, we need this many outlets. And instead of, we have no idea, we should make sure that, you know. So I would always see this tension between, if you give us something concrete that we can just do, that's great, we want to do that, versus thinking expansively. And so that was a constant tension. And so certain scientists would say something very strongly worded, and that would send the team off in a certain direction
mm-hmm.
Because it was actionable,
yeah.
even if it wasn't visionary.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it was both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Getting back to the script a little bit. The institutes are kind of an experiment, and looking ahead 5 years, from your perspective, how will we know if that experiment has succeeded or if it's going well?
That's a great question, and that's something that, well, I know we've been looking to you guys to help us think about metrics.
I know, and we throw it right back in your face.
And in fact, I was just in the meeting just before you came, working with one of my advisory board members on the question of metrics. So
mm-hmm.
I think metrics are a hugely important thing for us to be thinking about now, taking baselines and articulating what our expectations and goals are. And then I think we need to come back to them, and I think we need to devise practices to refine them as we go. How will we know? It sort of sounds like you're asking about specific metrics.
Well, you can approach it either way. I mean, you know, I guess one way to approach the question would be to say, in general, people's expectations of what this experiment is going to be all about, what's going to happen in this building, what's going to
right.
happen with these organizations, what's going to happen in terms of scientific
mm-hmm.
Innovation and training and public
mm-hmm.
service.
Right.
Another would be to say, yes, we really have to measure this place and the activity that occurs in this place and the resources it commands
right.
compared to other things within the university
right.
or without. I mean, so
right.
there's... whichever way that you've been thinking
right.
about the question most
right.
recently is
right.
fine.
So I think I spend most of my time thinking about the town center because that's my job now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the same kinds of things apply in different ways to the two institutes. I mean, for the two institutes themselves, the goals there, I think you can best say are, you know, to promote new avenues of discovery. So are there a disproportionately high number of impactful publications and
mm-hmm.
patents and things that
mm-hmm.
come out of them,
mm-hmm.
and 5 years
mm-hmm.
might be too short of a window to look at,
mm-hmm.
although you could probably look at a curve.
Yeah.
and get a sense relative to the rest of campus. Retention and recruitment is another one of the stated goals of the institutes, to attract new talent to the university that wouldn't come otherwise. So Sang Kim articulates, I mean, he really wants to take the discoveries thing to the next level and really have, startup activity and revenue generation from impact, you know, market impact coming out of mortgage. Obviously, 5 years is way too short a horizon to look at that. Grant revenue, again, you know, I guess I put that publications, patents, grants that come as a result of work going on within the building or just the nature of some of the collaborations. So, you know, not all of it's going on within the building, but just sort of spurring this kind of culture. Are we making a shift in some of the research culture itself? And I think that's a controversial one, because I think a lot of people feel that UW is always already great at collaboration, and what's this one little building going to do to impact that culture? I guess I would argue that by being such a big gorilla, and partly because of WRF's ability to just get a lot of attention, and we have a marketing machine all our own, that I think we've made a lot more noise than an average research building on campus has done, that we should be stimulating certain activities. And we had that seed grant effort in 2006, I think it was, designed to just sort of prime the pump a bit. So yeah, that's a hard one to measure, you know, but maybe some of the new collaborations might say in an interview that they were inspired by the WIT experiment or something they saw, or a conversation with one of the scientists in there. So that's a harder one, but all of those kinds of things for the institutes. And then from my perspective, I'm working actively right now on metrics, and am focusing on things like STEM education and engagement with local schools, and attitudes around science and the university, and designing some metrics around that, around business acceleration and community awareness of what's going on campus and at the institutes. So not just the institutes, but also on campus. Can we create a forum to raise awareness? So I'm going to be looking at metrics around that. STEM, business acceleration, and then just, you know, again, this question of collaboration across campus and between the university and campus, and are we able to move the needle on those things?
In terms of, I mean, I think it's interesting to kind of separately for a moment conceptualize, okay, how will the research endeavors be seen in terms of success? How will the town center efforts be seen as in terms of success? So how tied are the two fates there, right, in terms of how they will be? And again, it's a tricky question, you know, on purpose to think about both, you know, what you might value as success, or or might point to as measures of success, and I know you're wrestling with that in a very specific way. And also in terms of what the outside world or the UW community or whatever public might be involved might look at and think of that. So how would you see that the fate of the town center, or evaluations 5 years, 10 years out of the town center, and evaluations of the research enterprise there as being tied together?
That's a really good question. So I think certainly job one of the town center is to be an asset to the institutes, to enable them to do the kinds of going beyond themselves that they need to do to be successful, to achieve these things, to drive good collaborations, to be strong recruitment engines. The town center should be a vehicle for those things, not the only one, but a major one. I mean, if they were in the old biochemistry building, you would expect that those outcomes would be different. I mean, if we're successful, there should be a difference between what you had anticipated if they were in a crappy old building versus being here. So they're certainly tied in that way. But that said, the town center isn't only meant to be a megaphone for the two institutes. It's really meant to be a resource that can be catalytic for the entire campus and the campus community interface. So it's just, again, in a meeting with someone very interested in how the community can view the town center as a portal into the university, and how it can be a recruitment tool for students and for community members of color who don't otherwise necessarily come into the university. So there are metrics around that that are somewhat independent of how successful, say, John Yin's research program is. But John Yin's research program being successful might create things that are inspirational that we do in the town center. So if we have a very cool talk or a very cool experiment in the discovery niche that may, you know, so they're tied.
Right.
Substantively in terms of content.
Right.
And then, you know, I of course won't have been successful if I haven't made the Town Center an asset to the Institute. Mm-hmm. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So turn that around in terms of challenges to those sort of, that dual mission of the Town Center, put it that way, right? What are some challenges that you anticipate or that you could imagine either making either one or both of those work together?
Yeah, I mean, the very first challenge I feel is that the differential engagement that the scientists at the institutes have with these other goals. I mean, some of them are very focused on their research programs, and this is not their priority. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that, it's not that hard to make sure they know what's available to them. It's harder to get them to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, will they give a lecture to the public?
Right.
Will they put something in the discovery niche? Can we make them a magnet for mm-hmm. some of our goals at the Town Center? There's a spectrum.
Yeah.
And some of the scientists up there are incredibly excited about it and are just throwing themselves into it, and others do not come to any meetings or conversations. So that's hard because it's uneven, and I have no authority over any of them to make them do anything.
Right.
So I'm sort of a little bit at the whim of the scientists themselves. Mm-hmm. Another challenge is campus perceptions of the specialness of those scientists and of other people's access to the Town Center, mm-hmm. and making sure that I'm able to serve, you know, and I know that Carl worries about this, that we do right by the institutes at the same time as not engendering or creating resentment on the part of the rest of the campus mm-hmm. against the institutes, mm-hmm. or having them feel that somehow their work is less worthy of, commanding attention mm-hmm. in the Town Center. Mm-hmm. So that
right.
balance is challenging.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, those are great examples. We've just been talking about the next couple of questions. I'm going to jump forward a little bit and ask a similar set of questions in a slightly different way. So we've been talking about the public and the broader community and a lot of the promotional materials and sort of designs of the Institute are about the public and the broader community. So how should we think about this? Specifically, what... This might seem kind of a weird question, but who are the publics or the audiences mm-hmm. for the institutes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we had to start thinking about who are we speaking to? Who are mm-hmm. we doing this for? Who are we performing for?
Right. No, that's a great question, and it comes up all the time. And I would say it's everybody is in one of the publics. So I like to think of it as kind of concentric circles. So
mm-hmm.
the first public is the institutes themselves upon one another, so
yes.
that the scientists within don't just become people down a hall from one another, which they won't, but and then each of those scientists have their own research groups that are beyond the building, so
mm-hmm.
that's another and then there's the campus enterprise. So there's the scientific one, so that's another radiating circle. So you know, the three branches of science that are supposed to come together here, bioinfo, nano,
right.
If you're bio, you're a public when it comes to nano,
mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you need to have that work made accessible to you. So fostering that level of scientific collaboration and everything in between those, you know, math and, I mean, there's lots of things in between that
right.
wheel.
Right.
So that's another level. And then there's the rest of campus. We've talked a lot about wanting meaningful engagement between science and humanities, science and social science,
mm-hmm.
science and art, and everything else that we leave out. Education, of course, is another one. So creating that kind of intellectual community
mm-hmm.
still within the campus world.
Mm-hmm.
Education, all education. So K-12 is a very visible set of the public, teachers and students and families and administrators. But there's education beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's undergraduate education, there's
mm-hmm.
lifelong learners, there's members of the community that... I think we all feel we have a vested interest in being a resource for, like, legislators and
mm-hmm.
judges and
mm-hmm.
practitioners. So there are those publics. There is your average taxpayer who owns this public university
mm-hmm.
who may not always understand how she relates to it
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. as a part of the public. And then there's sort of the example. One of the reasons we engaged you guys to do this project, are there things that that the institutes can learn from and bring to the rest of the world doing, you know, research and intellectual engagement and having an academy. So I think that's everybody.
That was an incredibly thorough answer to a very vague question. I'm impressed. Clearly, you've been thinking a lot about your role. No, that's great. We've almost exhausted the interview script here. I want to ask you if there's anything else, as we've been kind of talking about this from different angles, anything else that has come to mind that you think might be good to get into the historical record about this. So again, you know, particularly from your perspective and your unique vantage point in this project, what else might we want to know?
I guess I would say I've always been fascinated by the process that this community has undergone around this project, and I think it's something to study, and I think it's instructive for how people behave. So I've watched this project be something that almost everybody was afraid of, and resentful, and watch people's first response be one of concern or competition. And I feel like there's like this phylogeny that everybody goes through as this project comes into them. So as I reach out to different people in the community or on campus, the first thing is competition, fear. And then it can move to understanding really how there could be a whole new vistas of collaboration and opportunity. And it's been fascinating to watch. I don't think I know anybody that hasn't gone through that process of first being concerned and worried and feeling competitive, and then, I mean, hopefully, I mean, there's some people that are still there. And then hopefully getting to a place of seeing opportunity and being excited and engaged. So I guess just that there's some lesson in there for how we respond to newness or to new opportunities. And yet there's not a lot of sort of meta process around that, so that people don't come into it knowing that, yes, well, of course, so-and-so is going to go through that because that's what happens. When I first connected with Bob Forrester, you know, I called him on the phone, and I told him what we were doing. He's like, let me guess. I'm guessing that the administration at the university is incredibly worried about competition. I'm guessing that most of the faculty are really resentful that a handful are going to go in there. And I'm like, have we met? And apparently all of these enterprises, as they've come online, have experienced this. It's just like this birthing pattern, the Whitehead, the Broad. And some of these things have led to schisms that have never healed. And have caused these institutions to go through a certain kind of, you know, embattled stance. I think that's still existing here with respect to particularly fundraising and development is one that there's a lot of potential for synergy and mutual benefit. It's not clear that people some people are there and some people aren't there. It would be great if somebody could engage a conversation around that at some point in this process. Not that everyone has to come around and sing kumbaya, but just to recognize that it just seems to me like a universal response.
Having gone through this example, this case, through that phylogeny, are there other ideas in the works around the UW campus that you see that might, whether they realize it or not, sort of learn from this experience the institutes?
Yeah, I've had conversations. I'm good friends with the person heading up the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And he's talked about some similar kinds of things. I mean, that one's less ecumenical in its approach. I mean, that's pretty topic-focused, and you either have something to do with sustainability and bioenergy or you don't, whereas here we're talking to all the public, so you know, you feel like everybody has a reason to care. So it's a little bit different. But, yeah, I would say new enterprises in general should, I mean, sort of look at that phylogeny and prepare for it, maybe manage it. I don't know how to manage it. Yeah. We haven't, don't think, managed it. I don't know how to do that, but it would be great if someone could find a way to, paint that picture.
Are there any examples from the history of this place, this campus, that folks that you're involved with talk about? In contrast, like say, oh, well, when we did this initiative or built this building or created this grouping, it was the same thing, or this is very different? I mean, what points of reference do people use when they are thinking about
the response to it, or the
Was this seen as this is the first time this campus has embarked on something so all-encompassing that, like you said, it hits all the publics, that it claims and tries to encompass the whole place, so it brings that level of scrutiny and concern.
Well, and I think, I don't know. I think what's different, and we talked about this in the beginning, I think what's the hallmark that's different about this project is that nobody asked for this gift. This gift was given, the campus had to let it fit.
Okay.
Whereas when there's other new buildings, it's because a group of people got together and said, we want a new microbial sciences building, we want a new biochemistry building. So the public there is, there's a band of champions in the beginning, and here there wasn't really.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is made some of the major difference. So, I don't know enough about the history of different projects on campus. I know that when we talked to Rogers Hollingsworth, he talked about other sort of institutes within the campus that had been models. He talked about the Enzyme Research Center and McCardle Labs and Math Research Center. And sort of their demises, and had cautionary tales for us about that. Got some books for me to read about that. Other people have also gave me a book. There's a book on the Math Research Center, which had been here, and its demise, with this cautionary tale, like it's the end of the world if you let these things happen. I don't know. I think Wimmer is an interesting example because it's come along at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And has had to, but I think there, it started with, it was someone here's, someone who was already here was their idea.
Yeah.
So okay. I think this may be unique, but I may be ignorant.
Okay. Well, it's a really good thing for us to keep our eyes on, too. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's what is different about this, is that someone said, we'd like you to do this, not like, here's what we want to do, can we have money?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Anything else you'd want to add at the end?
I don't think so. Now I'll have questions about the embargoing thing.
Sure.
I don't know if that's after the.
Yep, we can stop the tape. So thank you very much for the hour, and I'm going to go ahead and stop both recorders now.